This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2016, held at Faith Builders on August 1 through 5.
I'm just wondering if I should start with routines or multitasking. Timetable is pretty important, too. Just to focus our attention here. Let's see. I'm not sure if that's right or not. No, it's not right. Sorry about that. Well, I guess I sort of ran out of space there. It looks sort of weird, but I really wish now that I would have planned for this a little better. I do have a handout. Anyone see the handout? Yes, I remember. Would one of you fellows at the back, would you go to the little entry here? And in the lost and found, I remember I put it there. So I think that's where it will be. Yeah, just on the shelf, right? Or go straight ahead. Yeah. Okay. I could have done that just as well myself when I go to fill my water bottle.
Can we pass them out?
Let's see. We could take a vote on that. Yeah, go ahead. Hand them out, please. You can get some help from somebody else, perhaps. Let's see now. What else was there? I'm really embarrassed about this. I'm going to rub it off, I think. Well, maybe that's enough of that sort of style. How not to do things. We're talking about multi-grade classroom management, and we will follow a bit of a outline on your handout. I am a little more organized than what I was demonstrating there, but that does have some resemblance to classrooms, maybe not the first day, but maybe a month into school, where we sort of wing it, and sometimes our flying isn't very good. So let's consider the Bible principle, first of all. A couple times in the New Testament, it says about redeeming the time. So Ephesians 5:16 would be one of these. Is there anyone else who needs a handout? All right, thank you very much, fellas. So that applies not only to church life, it applies to school life. Redeem the time, or making the most of your time is how some translations say. So being efficient, managing things well. So that's a Bible principle. Next, let's look at the idea of being efficient. There are some benefits of having an efficient classroom. For one thing, the students have more opportunity to learn because the teacher is not wasting time, as I was demonstrating here in the first 3 minutes or so. Students have more opportunity to learn. Secondly, the teachers have more time for preparation because they have been efficient, as well as for actual instruction, and also more time for supper, which is something that appeals to me fairly strongly at the end of the day. But some teachers seem to not be that attracted to supper, and so skip it, which I don't think is a real good idea. Another benefit the school board can pay the teachers more if they're efficient teachers, because they don't need as many teachers or having another helper. So most of us would, I think, conclude that that's a pretty noteworthy idea of the school board paying us more. Now, here's a few things that promote an efficient classroom. The teacher's personal manner. My personal manner was not very exemplary here at the beginning. The teacher's personal manner and example is important. So I direct you to the master teacher and Matthew 5, the first couple verses says, "And seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain, and when he was set," okay, that was his personal manner. And for the Jews, a Mideastern culture, the teacher always sat. And so when he was set, so his class is organized, he's set, he's ready, he opened his mouth. That's another good idea for you as teachers. Don't mumble. He opened his mouth and taught them. So here are some ideas for efficiency. Be prompt. So that's for you. I guess I could have wandered in here late, which wouldn't have been a real productive idea. You can also insist on promptness. In my classroom, I have already had the problem with the students being slow and coming in for recess. And so I've needed to work on promptness with them. And I know some teachers have offered rewards then, keeping track of, let's say they have 3 minutes to get into their seats or something like that after the bell sounds to end recess. And so they'll keep track of how many minutes it took, and if their students are getting in a minute and a half to their desk, then they keep a running tally of how many minutes the student saved, and then they get extra recess or a reward of some sort. So anyway, be prompt yourself and insist on promptness with the students. Part B, be concise on the phone. If you get a phone call, you have to answer it. I serve as principal as well as teacher in grades 7 to 10 at Fairhaven Christian School in Ontario. I do get phone calls from parents or sometimes salesmen, and I'm very concise with salesmen, I must say. And anyway, try not to waste time there. Walk fairly quickly. Walk quickly. Don't dawdle as far as your movement around the classroom. And use bunny trails judiciously. In other words, some students like to get us sidetracked and go down a bunny trail. And so it's all right to entertain those little avenues, but don't overdo it and don't do it regularly. Keep on target. And also have a professional appearance. I think our appearance does communicate order. Not real enthused about flip-flops and teachers in the classroom, that sort of thing. However, I'm not a lady teacher, and I don't expect I ever will be, so I sometimes might act like one. Make good use of routines in the second place. I said, first of all, the teacher's personal manner and example is important. Make good use of routines, but don't let the lesson become routine. So let's think, first of all, about entering a classroom. So I'd like to ask you some questions, have some involvement by way of answers. How was it done in the school that you attended or the school that you're going to be teaching in, as far as how students enter the classroom or what they do when they get to school? Particularly, I'm thinking of actually beginning the school day as far as instruction is concerned. So how I think there are various ways. I'm interested in hearing how it has been done in your particular setting. So So as soon as they come into the classroom. And then they sit in their seat, or they mingle with each other, or they play a game.
They usually mingle with each other and play games.
And then how does the teacher indicate that it's time for classes to begin? Little bell, let you, okay, and that's the signal. Okay, that's one way. Another way? So they can't come to school before 10 minutes to starting time?
Yeah.
And then they enter the classroom and they mingle or work at some unfinished work? Or, and then how, is it again a little bell that sounds? Or
I'm sorry?
How does the teacher call things to order then?
Yeah.
There's a bell that sounds, or a,
yeah.
Sometimes bells are automatic and might be a warning bell and a final bell. Mm-hmm. Other ways. Is that? And then there's a bell that sounds.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The school where I teach, they get there. We don't really like them there before 20 minutes sometimes. Generally, it's about 10 minutes before starting time. And they are free to go out and play. Might play a bit of basketball. We don't have a gymnasium. So it's outdoors. We don't really like them tearing around. We have a two-story school, but they can mingle in the basement. So some of them play, some of them don't. Our school begins at 9 o'clock. And so then we ring a bell. And at that point, they enter the school. And the rule is, once they're inside the school, after the bell has sounded, there is no more talking. It's quiet. And I always have them line up. All the classes have the students line up by gender. And then when everybody's in line, or practically everyone's in line, then the signal is given to enter the classroom. For me, it's going upstairs. And so I have particular rules about how they walk up the stairs. They need to do it. The first person has to go step by step, one step at a time. After that, it doesn't matter. But if the first one is leading the pack, the rest pretty well need to follow the same way. And so if the first day I explain how I want it to be done, when they go downstairs again at recess time, then I want them to go one step at a time for safety reasons. Some of them can go pretty fast otherwise. And so if the student does not follow those instructions, let's say the first day they sort of tear up the stairs and instead of an orderly way, then I bring them all back down again and we stand there and think about it a little bit and then we do it all over again. And so don't be afraid to insist on the way you want it to be from the very first day. So that's just how we've done it, but there are other ways of doing it. And any other comments or questions about entering the classroom? Okay. Exiting the classroom. The first school where I taught, we always lined up at the side of the classroom. And we were quiet until the signal was given for a dismissal. You can simply say class excused, or maybe there's a bell that sounds, and maybe row by row or by grade. However, have things done in an orderly way. Fire drills, exiting the school in that respect. Tell them very plainly. Do a practice when the fire alarm is not sounding. And just be sure that everybody knows what they're doing and do it several times, and so it becomes a routine. Exchange of papers is the next thing I'd like to talk about. and workbooks. You want it to be sort of an automatic thing, whether it's backwards or forwards or sideways or whatever. We in Canada tend not to collect nearly as many papers and workbooks and so on. I'll explain a little more about how we do things with marking of books, grading of books, but we do have exchange of papers and so on. So put some thought into how you want that done and explain it clearly to them. Next, movement in the classroom. It can be a source of a lot of disorder. I would suggest that you be fairly restrictive at first as to how much movement there is. I don't have the students leave the room without permission, unless it's an emergency, and one of those emergencies is if they need to use the restroom urgently. Or if they're going to be sick, then I want them to clear out of the classroom as fast as possible and get to the restroom. And so I just tell them that, you can leave without permission if it's an emergency. If it becomes a rather frequent emergency, then I will have a conversation with the parents and see if they can make an appointment with the doctor to have things checked out. And they get the point that they're not to abuse that privilege. Next, distribution and collection of materials. They can be taught to put their own paper on top of the other papers or below the other papers, so it's in a consistent order. Concerning restroom use, part F, there are various ways to accommodate the need to use the restroom during the day, particularly with younger children. And I'd be interested in hearing what you think works well for the restroom procedures. Something's going nuts out there, is on the way it sounds. Anyhow, it's stopped now, so we can continue. When a student needs to use the restroom, what do you suggest by way of communicating that to the teacher for permission? How has it been done? How have you seen it done? Show me a hand signal. You want to go use the restroom? Show me a suitable hand signal. Victory! Okay. Okay. And so then the teacher would nod when recognition, and then the student would leave. Okay. Any other ways?
We have a little card that we put back in the classroom, and then if they go, they just automatically take it. And so then only one person can go at a time.
Okay, so you don't have a little party, because only one person can use the restroom. So there's a restroom card, and if they need to use the restroom, they take it and then bring it back and put it. Okay, good idea. Others?
We have different colored flags.
Flags?
And so the one color is for like short questions and stuff. And I just captured who was out and who wasn't.
Uh-huh. So colored flags and you, is this an individualized classroom? Yeah. So that works well. Any others? Yes. Same as in this group. If you need to use the restroom, you go. You don't have to put up two fingers or a flag or whatever else. Or they can simply raise their hand as with any other question. So, no right or wrong way of doing it. What works best for you. Use of library books. I don't like students to be heading to the library. We have a library of a couple hundred books right in our classroom, and I don't like them while I'm conducting a lesson for them to be going and getting a library book or reading a library book for that matter. But then getting one as they require one. A dictionary. How many like to have a dictionary in the student's desk or right close by? Raise your hand. How many of you have them go and find a dictionary? How many have never heard of a dictionary? No. Okay, any questions so far? Thoughts? And the third aspect of things that promote an efficient classroom is to be prepared. Preparation builds confidence. Okay, so I wasn't feeling too confident here today. I didn't know what I was doing. And you were probably having some serious questions about this guy up here at the front as to what was going on. Remember, I did something like this some years ago in a teacher's workshop, and my board chairman was present in the audience, and he thought I had totally lost it. He could not figure out what was going on. However, if you know what's going to be happening, what you want to have happening in the classroom, you feel confident and you communicate that confidence to the students, and then they feel more secure. But primarily it's your own manner. Also, preparation avoids discipline problems, because if the teacher is unsure of himself and the students pick up those vibes, they feel insecurity, and insecurity breeds discipline problems. Furthermore, preparation allows you to know where you're going. Okay, so you've thought things through, and so you're not wasting time as I was at the beginning of this lesson. And preparation means you have the materials that you need at hand. So if I'm teaching a lesson in grade 8 or so about circumference of a circle, then I'm going to want to have the students measure the circumference of tin cans and soccer balls and various things that are circular. So I want to have those accessible. I want to have some string. I want to have a measuring tool, a yardstick or a meter stick or some measuring tool. So I want to have all that sort of thing readily at hand. So if it's a lesson about agriculture in Mexico, then I'm going to want to have some labels or some products or a map. I have my things prepared anyway. So preparation allows you to have the materials that you need at hand. Now let's think about managing plural grades. So we're going to use a little object lesson here involving you. So I'm going to be asking you in a few moments to stand. And I'd like you to pat one of your cheeks as you're standing. And at the same time, I'd like you to be rubbing your tummy. And then I also want you at the same time to be humming "Jesus Loves Me." And I also want you to be counting to 10 at the same time. So stand up, please. I'll repeat those instructions. So you're supposed to stand, and you're supposed to pat one cheek, and you're supposed to rub your stomach, and you're supposed to hum, and you're supposed to count to 10 now. And jump in the air 3 times. All right, thank you. Sit down. Anyway, that's a little bit the sensation I get in teaching 3 or 4 grades. 2 is not as bad, but it gets the classroom tends to resemble a 3-ring circus. So you did very well. It's difficult just to remember all that stuff, much less to actually do it. So teaching one grade, I've done that my first couple years of teaching. Just had one grade in the classroom. And there are, in bigger schools, just one grade. More often, 2 grades in our schools, I think, in a classroom. So that
affects the multi-grade classroom approach. But some of us have, I have four, grade 7 to 10. I have a grade 11 student this year also. That'll be working more on an individualized basis. I have taught all the grades from grades 1 to 10, except there were a few grades missing, with about 15 students already. One year, it was actually when our daughter Esther was in grade 10, I think. I had grades 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and I had a total of 36 students. I had forgotten about that, except that I made a train, and every car of the train had the list of the students in grade 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 and 10. It was a pretty decent year. I had sort of forgotten how many students I had in some of those years. Last year I had 20. This next year I have 27 in grade 7 to 10. So, you can drive a car and talk and listen to a CD and pray and... Well, I've shaved already on the way to school, and I try not to fall asleep. There's a limit to multitasking as to what you can do. Anyway, my suggestion is that you combine. So if you rub your stomach and count to 10, that's manageable. So look for ways to teach the entire class as a group. So... I've listed some examples there. You can have, if you have a devotional period, which I think most of our schools do, that would be with the entire class, and that's one thing that makes devotions time enjoyable for me. However, if you have particularly a range of grades, a range of ages in your classroom, remember to feed the lambs. If you feed the lambs, the older ones will have something to eat as well. So don't talk over top of the kids. This is a big problem as far as I'm concerned with fathers and ministers coming in and talking to the whole school. They tend to shoot for the upper grades because that's the level that they think on. And then the little tykes in first and second grade are looking around and shuffling their feet and poking the person beside them. And so, feed the lambs. You can also have art class with everybody. The composition class, I think, works pretty well because you've got a theme. They're writing on different levels of ability. How many of you expect to read a story after lunch or whatever suitable time? Fairly common thing. You're setting an example of an enunciation, of pronunciation, of expression. And my opinion, it's fun to read a story. A good story. It's a highlight for me. And, I'm not afraid to make lots of racket in reading the story and make it as realistic as I can, so... The other teachers, well, I hear them too. Esther teaches right across the way from me, so I hear her giving great expression to the stories that she reads. Penmanship, difference, of course, between a grade 3 and a grade 8 student in their ability. Certainly phys ed can be done with a range of ages. And music class. So there's... I would say in my day, about a third of the day, I'm talking to the entire group, grades 7 to 10. So it's not as onerous and difficult as it may appear on first blush. There are some subjects that are difficult to combine, grade 1 and 2 reading, for example. And there are some things that simply don't... I haven't found a way of combining certain grades or classes. So let's have you try a little exercise here. I'd like you to roll your eyes. Okay, roll your eyes. Stop doing that. Now roll your eyes and your tongue the same direction. Okay, it's fun watching you do, by the way. And now I want you, and I'm not going to try it even because I get a pounding headache when I do this, but roll your eyes one direction and have your tongue go the opposite way. Okay? Give it a shot. Give it a try. My brain just does not handle that. So my point is here, there are just some things that are impossible or likely to cause a headache in the classroom. Same sort of thing if you're wanting to try it is, it doesn't have to be the tongue, it can be your foot going one way and your eyes another direction. I don't know, how does it work with a hand? Hand going one way and foot, you can try that. Hand going one way and foot the... I just have so many limitations, it's not funny. So, however, you can de-emphasize some subjects. We've used rod and staff curriculum quite a bit over the years, and so that's heavily Bible content in the first four grades. And so we wouldn't have a separate Bible class if we're having a heavy concentration of Bible content in the reading program. Some aspects of grammar I de-emphasize depending on how much time I have. And high school electives, of course, because they are electives, they can be done or can be omitted. Now, some suggestions for efficiency, unless you have a question about combination of classes. Anything? Yes.
Our school is 1 through 7.
Okay.
Would you put some of the, like, second grade with the 7, with 5, 6, and 7, or 1, 2, 3, and 4 together?
Is this one teacher?
Two
teachers. So
second
how?
Second grade is somewhat slow learners or special ed.
You've got 2 through 7.
No, 1st through 7.
1st through 7.
All the lower grades in one, upper grades in the other, or would you split the 1st and 2nd grade?
Mm-hmm. You know, one school of about 75 or so. No, wouldn't have that many students at that time. Anyway, they had grades 1 and 2 together and grades 7 and 8 together. And the teacher was comfortable with that. There certainly would be some advantages as far as older students helping the younger ones if they're in the same classroom. However, as far as doing things as a group, there's some complications with that. You know, even something like story time. So you have a story about Reddy Fox and then another one about Michael Sattler. So you read a paragraph for the Reddy Fox and one of Michael Sandler. I don't know how you do that. So I would tend to favor grades 1 to 3 and 4 to 7, something like that, or maybe depending on the number of students that would be in those grades. Anyone have any experience with mixing older ones and younger ones?
We've tried it in some years past, and it hasn't been the most favorable outcome. We prefer to keep the younger ones.
Any particular complications that you...
Well, one thing that was a bit of a problem for us was even just break time. Generally, the classrooms have break together, and so high schoolers want to play ball, but, you know, the lower grade, it's just, yeah, stuff like that.
Some logistical problems, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
I'm going to have 1st, 2nd, and 6th this year, but we're a very small school.
1, 2, and 6, you say?
1, 2, and 6.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not sure, you know, even I think what we might do is maybe do some story time. Maybe you have fourth and sixth with one teacher, and first, second, and third with another teacher, just because of the, I'm not sure how you read story in first, second, and sixth.
Yeah. You know, it's been quite a few years since I taught grades 1 through 10. And I don't actually remember the stories that I would have read, but they would have been on probably on a grade 3, 4 level, but with a high interest for, I mean, if you've ever watched a children's class in church, you can realize that those who are 6 or 7 years of age may not be listening any more carefully than their parents or their grandparents. So it's depending what it is. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? All right. Suggestions for efficiency now. The timetable. Arrange the timetable suitably. So put some thought into that. Work with your principal if you have one, or administrator. And it's important to have a balance in your timetable as far as having the various subjects represented with a suitable amount of time devoted to each subject. And avoid handling teacher-intensive subjects at the same time. So, in my classroom, we have devotions together, first of all, and then I'll have spelling with grades 7 and 8. And for that, I like just 2 grades rather than 3, but 3 will work too. Then I have my books, and I just have 1 word for the grade 7 class and next word for grade 8, and use it in a sentence and so on. And then I get right into grade 7 and 8 math. I find I can handle 2 math classes. I've already tried handling 3 or 4, and it's tough to give adequate. So at the same time, I have grade 9 and 10 here. Let's say they're doing history or geography, which would be pretty typical. And so I like to, I have something called worksheets, outline sheets. They make their own notes. I'll hand these out probably a little later. But it's something that they can work on their own. And so I can just assign it to them. And I can get right at spelling, which doesn't have usually that much of a point of contact, but certainly in mathematics. And so the one grade, let's say I'm introducing addition to fractions. So I might spend 10, 15 minutes developing that. And at the same time, my grade 8 will be doing something that they learned the previous day. And so they're reviewing it. They're applying what they learned. So they're working at an assignment. And my tendency is to have students work at the blackboard. We have 6 large blackboards, 2 on the side, and 4 across the front of my classroom. I have a fairly large classroom, which I appreciate very much. And so I'll have the students working at the blackboard. I'll call them up to the blackboard and work through the lesson, and then have them individually work at the blackboard as I make up questions and to see how they're doing. So after I've got this done, maybe in 15 minutes, then I can either work, or I'll probably go to the students in grade 8, maybe give a little review of what they've done, again at the chalkboard, and then I launch into my 5-stage lesson plan, a point of contact, saying what the goal of this lesson is, developing the lesson, summarizing it, and then giving them practice at the chalkboard and at their seat. So we're now 40 minutes or so So these students, I may have been answering a few questions or telling a little story to them in between that transition. But then presumably I have maybe 10, 15, 20 minutes while these folks are all working at their mathematics problems and review and drill and so on. So then that's during that time that I'll discuss the history lesson or the geography lesson. And so that's what I mean by not having... I could have 9 and 10 math, you know, at the same time, but there's just too many things happening for me to handle it all. So if you can, on a lower grade, in grade 3 and 4 level, maybe it's social studies and math, or an easier reading course and a harder reading course, or simply having, again, the same idea that the one class, one grade is doing things that they're familiar with, they need it reinforced, they need practice in it while you're teaching the other lesson. Any questions about that? So alternate points of contact, in other words, the new lessons, with assignments. That's what I was describing there. So you can't very well have a point of contact for two grades at the same time on different subjects. Number 3. Oops. With assignments involving work that has already been introduced. So alternate points of contact with assignments involving work that has already been introduced. How many of you remember your teacher? You probably don't remember what you did in school, but do you remember anything like that? That you were alternating? It just happened, probably. You were. Any comments? Okay. Number 3, let older students help those who are younger. And let's say you have... Well, maybe I should ask you, how many have 2 grades and only 2 grades in your classroom? Stand up, please. You can look around. So we're talking here, not quite half that are blessed in that way. Okay, thank you. Stand up if you've got 3. Almost as many. Thank you. And 4, which is what I have. Boy, a pretty good distribution here. Thank you. And more than 4. God bless you, noble souls. Yeah, it can be done, but it's it has its challenges. So, what's an advantage of having older students help younger students? You tell me.
Well, it creates a relationship between the older ones and the younger ones that it bridges that gap.
Mm-hmm. Can do that.
Gives the older students an opportunity to teach.
Okay, and some of them sort of like that, yeah. And the best way to learn something really well is to teach it. Other advantages?
Sometimes the students can explain it to each other better than the teacher.
It's true, because they've been a little closer to it, and they remember how it was for them. Now, and some of our students are very talented, so it's possible. Any others? Helps the teacher, of course, because they're not. So indirectly it helps the students, because the teacher can devote time. Any disadvantages of older ones helping younger ones?
Sometimes, well, it'll depend how you do it, but if you just have the younger ones, hold up their hand and the older ones hold them anytime they want to, sometimes the younger ones will take it.
Okay. So you've experienced that the younger one will take advantage of this opportunity, and whenever they get stuck or they don't work through the problem themselves. Uh-huh. Someone else?
You have to know your students sometimes can an ego trip.
Can be jealous, depending, you know, if it's just the
I'm capable of explaining it.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Maybe you're better than the teacher.
Uh-huh. Or the student tells them that. May do a better job, but maybe do a lot poorer job, too. Now, if it's just checking something, if it's just marking their work, that's a different story. I know in our school last year, Esther Bean, in grade, teaching grade 1 and 2, had 23 students. And so at 15 minutes to lunchtime, I sent capable grade 10 student over to her class. She just quietly left the classroom. And I forget if she did spelling class, did some grading. And so it was a big help just for that 15 minutes. If you have a reciprocal or an arrangement with among teachers, it doesn't have to even be within, just within their own classroom. Comments additionally about older ones helping younger ones? So you want it to be fairly routine so it doesn't become more work for the teacher than it's worth.
They have one student they were responsible to.
Uh-huh, yeah, certainly.
I did that a lot last year, but I had to be careful because some of my sixth graders flew through their work just so they could help the other ones.
Okay, so they... But it was considered a real privilege to do that. Still within the same classroom?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've found in grades, especially ones that may have a variety of learning speeds, like was mentioned, some of the students will get done faster. I personally prefer if my students will help someone outside of my class.
Outside of your class?
It kind of helps the whole ego thing a little bit.
Uh-huh. And you need to clear it with the school board to see if it really is okay, that sort of maneuvering. But it certainly can help. And years ago, my wife is not so terribly old, but she remembers going to a one-room school, 56 students, a few more in the wintertime. You know, we're talking about 1960s here. And... yeah, one teacher, 18-year-old. So you pretty well have to have older ones helping younger ones in that sort of a setting. So advantages and disadvantages, and use it in a way that is careful and that is acceptable and that works. Number 4, combine 2 grades and subjects where possible. So, I've got grades 7 to 10. Some of you have 4 grades or 3 grades or more. The more you can combine, the easier I find it anyway to be. So, what are some subjects that can be combined regularly, in your opinion or experience?
Science.
What grades?
7 and 8, 5 and 6.
No. Our grade 1 and 2 teacher, Esther, she does grade 1 and 2 together. And the living history thing is combines a flip back and forth between grade 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. Okay, so science, social studies, others?
Bible.
Uh-huh, Bible class.
That'd be high school literature.
In my case, all of my 9 and 10 students do the same work except in typing, computer skills, and mathematics. So So that's how I cut corners quite drastically. Penmanship, foreign language, I teach a bit of French, history, geography. What are some subjects that you might combine but you're not quite sure whether it's a good idea or not? Any suggestions there? Five and six reading. If you have a grade five and six class, would you combine that or have separate? I don't know.
Together on sixth grade reading, and then my dad told me, which is kind of quite possible, to then just expect less, like, grade the answers according to the age of your student. So if the reading is a grade ahead of what their comprehension is, then expect less out of the answers. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. And as far as a grade on a report card, sometimes with tests, I use some ready-made tests, but a lot of my tests I make up because I know what I've taught and what I've emphasized and so on. And so I might have if I've got a range of ages or grades, then I might have an extra question or a harder question that would be just for the older students, the older grade. Other comments? Yes?
Thinking of combining English.
Mm-hmm.
They go over the same thing. Terminology is maybe ramped up a little bit, higher grades.
I haven't done that, but I see how you could. Now, if it's a course that advances the knowledge incrementally, like from year to year, is it a problem for them to, let's say they're doing the grade 6 course in grade 5 and 6, does it work okay to do the grade 5 course? Of course, most students don't mind doing the easier work. So if it's easy, it's fine with them. Other comments, questions?
You mentioned that you make up your own tests. Do you go kind of on the tests that you receive?
Well, I'm sort of old school, and when I started teaching, there were very few ready-made tests. And so I do use, if it's a good test that's already made up, then I will use it or adjust it. So, or alter it in some way. So, yeah, I'm interested in saving work also, but you can alter a ready-made test. So that's what I would typically do if it's good enough. But I also tend to use more essay questions, so with my age of students. So I can make up a test with essay questions in 5 or 10 minutes. It takes a whole lot longer to grade the things. But and I tend not to use the method that one teacher in grading essays. He said, he stands at the bottom of the stairs, takes the stack of tests, and throws them, and those that go the furthest there are the A's, and the lower ones are B's, and so on. I don't think he said it seriously, but... And even if two grades are covering the same topic, here, number 5 on the next page, arrange lessons. If two grades cover the same topic, so maybe it's studying fractions in grade 5 and 6, or diagramming, or measurement, or in science, studying about mammals, so you can have the same lesson about fractions with grade 5 and 6, or grade 7 and 8. Number 6, try to multitask. Think about the model teacher, Jesus. Did he multitask? You think of an example when he did two things at one time? He had a boat ride one time, didn't he? And he was on a pillow. I think he did teaching as he walked along. Anyway, try to multitask by using the chalkboard with some students while you are helping another teacher. So if you haven't visited my classroom, this is one of the features that you'll see. Probably a third to half the time I'll have a range of students at the chalkboard. And so I'll be developing the lesson, giving guided practice, making the questions a little harder each time. Okay, we can demonstrate this. Do I have a couple of volunteers that are real brave to go up there? And I'll give some questions. They'll be reasonable questions. They won't be baby questions. You two men right here, thank you very much for being willing to come up here. Grab yourself a writing tool. And I'd like for you to write some examples of routines in a classroom. So what are some routines? So while they're thinking about that and starting to write about, you know, exiting the classroom and handing in materials and so on, here's a student back here that has had their hand up, or I'm just coming to check. Very nice work, boy. That's really neat. That's good. And then I can come over here and check on these students, and yep, things are going well. Or I can answer a question. I might even mark, grade an answer. And then I can look up here. Yeah, they're doing a great job. Look how neat they are, too. All right, very good. And now, another question about, please write down how you feel about being picked on in a group of teachers. So write that down. So they're thinking about that. And now normally it'll be more drill and so on, but it allows me to move around the classroom. And, you know, I noticed there's a student here that's having trouble behaving or getting his work, so I might come and tap him on his head and so on. So, all right, thank you. You're doing great in art and
just my feelings.
All right, he's an emotional individual. Thank you very much for being a good sport with that. So that's a little bit the way that goes. Number 7. Let students grade as much of their work as possible. Now, the different school boards have different opinions about this. But I let students grade a lot of their work. And in CLE, of course, that it's intended. You can do a lot of that. However, take measures to prevent cheating. And even Esther in grade 2 has the students mark a lot of their work. So instead of handing it in, and you sit there for hour after hour after school, if they can mark it themselves, have a way of having them correct the work. So I will read off quite a few answers in class as well. And I largely trust them, but as I'm reading off answers in Bible or social studies or something like that, I'm constantly right in the area where they're doing their grading. So I can see whether they're doing it right. Now, they can get some things by me, perhaps. And my orientation for making up report card marks is somewhat different than many in the States, in that I depend a lot on their daily work, because I know basically what they're doing, even though I'm not necessarily grading it myself. And I know how they're doing at the chalkboard. And so when a test comes, I'm not usually surprised at how they do. I pretty well know what they're likely to do on the test because I've kept in touch. So I do not have a grade book that gives a mark for Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday. I just have maybe four or five tests altogether in that grading period, which is we do it 3 times a year. And then I have an impression of what their work is on a daily basis in their workbook and at the chalkboard and discussion and their answers and so on. So it's a composite. It's not strictly just averaging the grades that they have received. 8, distinguish between essential and non-essential grading. So I have no great fondness for grading reams of books and materials. For younger grades, you really gotta mark a lot of it yourself. Reading, phonics, math, spelling. Non-essentials, art, and of course oral answers. For older grades, I mark the spelling and most of the math. If they're making their own notes, I keep an eye on things. Composition, I don't necessarily grade all of them, at least not carefully. And art and phys ed and singing and that sort of thing. Use self-study material such as light units. That can be a time saver. And worksheets. We use a fair bit of Christian light materials. And for a classroom approach, I really like the worksheet approach. If you're familiar with that, you can either use light units or sometimes questions in the textbook. But for grade 6 Latin America, for example, grade 4 reading, they're developing more and more where you just have a sheet of paper with questions on both sides. And that is a very efficient way of handling their written exercises. Some teachers like to use outline sheets, and I'll show you what that looks like. If I can have a couple of you, do you mind handing out those? So I'll explain a little more about that if I think of it later. Number 10, seat students according to grade. So I have it jumbled up somewhat in my classroom, but generally I have all the grade 10 students in one area. We have rows, 5 rows of desks. Other people like tables and so on. That's fine. I'm just saying what I'm used to. And so I'll have the high school students in one group. And thank you, girls. And grade 7 in another place. Of course, it depends on how many students are in a grade. So those outline sheets there that you're receiving, it follows a textbook, and they make their own notes, and we talk about it, and they can ask questions about things that they couldn't figure out. And that's largely what they study from. So something like that is still allows me to discuss things with them. This can help in such subjects as spelling, as they're all together and you're looking at them as you give the word. You give spelling words to several grades simultaneously or almost simultaneously, so I just jump back and forth, and it works pretty well. Sometimes they get mixed up, but they're pretty well trained not to. I always do it in the same order. 11, some teachers like pupils to use finger signals. We talked a little about that. And you can arrange for older students to do tasks that ease the teacher's workload. So I would sometimes have a teacher, a student appointed to do my photocopying if I need a photocopy of something that I, you know, a student forgot their book or something. Have you questions about any of these things? Yes.
Get your wife
to do it if you're married, or your husband, or your brother, or sister, or your parent, or grading compositions. Well, sometimes we'll emphasize certain things, like using comparisons or using conversation, and so you can concentrate on whatever you were emphasizing that day, and not necessarily grading everything. I used to mark everything with my red pen. I don't necessarily do that every time anymore. I'll look for the flow of the thought and their expression. And it's very subjective. So you can use a rubric of some sort where for punctuation and this sort of thing, and then come with a final tally. So for those of you in the new teacher orientation stream of thought. There will be a very detailed classroom management, particularly for younger grades. That might be helpful. We'll give that out this afternoon to those students. Any other questions? Yes?
I noticed that when you had these two guys up there working,
yeah,
or talking to the rest of us, or about, and most of us were watching him laughing at their pictures. What do you have any tips on doing that in the multi-grade classroom where I'm teaching a really interesting science class for 7th grade, mm-hmm, 6th grade? Is it just the sake of not realizing that next year they'll love that?
Yeah, well, I take it as a compliment if everybody's listening. But if they're really intent on getting their work done, in a multi-classroom setting, they do tune out the teacher fairly readily. And I don't feel offended if they listen in. But sometimes you just have to tell them to get to work or tone down your excitement so it's not quite as captivating for them. Okay, thank you very much for coming out for this. You're excused now. God bless you as you manage, as you are all managers in the classroom.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.